Well, I'm really pleased to introduce you to our first keynote speaker, the conference, Professor Tanya Staehler from the University of Sussex. Tanya's actually Professor of European Philosophy, I believe. And her current research, you may be aware of it already, focuses on bodily experiences and emotions of pregnancy, birth, and being with infants from a phenomenological perspective. Her research mediates between philosophers, parents, and healthcare professionals, such that perspectives can be shared as well as differences acknowledged. She's published numerous essays in this area, including articles in the journals Janus Head, Healthcare and Philosophy, and also in the Yearbook for Eastern and Western Philosophy. Tanya has written a considerable number of books as well. In 2016, she published a book on Hegel, Husserl, and the Phenomenology of Historical Worlds. She's also written on Plato and Levinas, and together with Michael Lewis, has published an introduction to phenomenology. So I'll hand you over to Tanya without any further ado, and say thank you again.
Yeah, thank you very, very much for having me. I feel a little bit guilty taking up such a large slot, given that other people this morning had to pack their interesting material into much shorter slots. But I need a little bit of time to tell you what this is all about. And I'm also very much in need of advice and feedback on this project that I'm just in the middle of. If by any chance you think that you have an interest in the project and would like to hear more about it in the longer run, or if you even think that you have some help to offer with the project, there's Rob Dunphy sitting there, and he has a piece of paper and a pen where I would be very grateful if you could leave your contact details so that I could potentially contact you later on. Okay. So this handout that I passed around, and apologies that there are not really quite enough copies you might have to share, has just only exactly the material that is going to be on the slides. And apologies in advance, all of this is going to be a little bit schematic. Heidegger says in some essay that he is going to ask purposefully, schematically, and in sort of essential streaks, so to speak. This is not as purposefully schematic. This is more an attempt to try and get this theory practice bit into the presentation. And that is because, on the one hand, I have done research and am in the process of writing a book on this topic. And what you have basically on the first page and second and first half of the second page is something like the table of contents prospectively of that book. So I'm going to sort of flip you through the book, as it were, not so much about part four, that's just there for completion purposes. So that would be the theory. And then the practice component, so to speak, is that I have done a module, an iLearn module, for the Royal College of Midwives. That was quite an interesting opportunity. This module consists of little film clips where, well, initially I had lectures of about 15 minutes, and then the Royal College thought that was somehow still too long, so we cut them down to 3 to 5 minutes. But it was, in any case, a really interesting opportunity to speak to an audience of practitioners. And the reason why I put all of this here together is because I'm hoping that you can indeed see some links there between the theory and the practice, and how the attempt went to transform the research into something much more practical. And I'm now still in the process of doing that. So I'm currently thinking about parents and whether there could be resources for parents. And that is specifically also something on which I would appreciate feedback and advice also after this occasion, if you have such. Okay, so I'm going to start with a recent story, as it were, that was in the Times. It was also in the Guardian and a bunch of other newspapers. Namely, the Royal College of Midwives stopped their normal births campaign, and they are now having a better births campaign. I will say about something about that in a moment. My module happens to be part of that new campaign, so that is already sort of going beyond the normal births thing, but it's quite interesting to think about what supposedly went wrong with the normal births campaign and also how they expressed it in vaguely philosophical terms. So this article, as you can see in the Times, was entitled Midwives Back Down on Natural Childbirth. Current policy makes women feel like failures. And then I have just a few important moments here from the article. Kathy Warwick, chief executive of the college, that is the Royal College of Midwives, denied that the campaign for normal birth, which has run since 2005, had compromised safety by making midwives shut doctors out of labor. In a significant climb down, however, she conceded that it had created the wrong idea and would end. Quote, "There was a danger that if you just talk about normal births, and particularly if you call it a campaign, it kind of sounds as if you're only interested in women who have a vaginal birth without intervention," she told the Times. "What we don't want to do is in any way contribute to any sense that a woman has failed because she hasn't had a normal birth. Unfortunately, that seems to be how some women feel." Unquote. And then the article explains that about 4 in 10 women give birth normally without cesarean induction instruments or epidural, down from 6 in 10 3 decades ago. Although the rise in older and heavier mothers has meant more complications, the college had argued that more women should be giving birth normally. That's a funny "should be" there from the philosophical perspective, I think. And here we have an explicit comment about language and terminology. Professor Warwick has concluded that it must be replaced by a broader, better births initiative of professional advice for midwives. Quote, "We would make absolutely sure under the Better Births initiative that we did use language and terminology that prevented people from thinking that we are going out there saying to midwives, you need to get a normal birth at all costs. We've never said that, but we can see how the terminology did let people think that was the case," Professor Warwick said. It does seem that this word normal is particularly contentious. It is simpler to use a non-value-laden word. Is better a non-value-laden word? I don't think so. But it's in any case an interesting reminder that terminology and language matter. There was then another article in the Times following up from the previous discussion. This was quite recently, I think just about a week ago. And the article was entitled Nightmare on the Maternity Ward, and starts with, "Last month, the Royal College of Midwives suspended its 12-year campaign to promote natural birth. About time," says Gracia editor Natasha Perlman, who reveals how an agonizing, drug-free labor left her traumatized physically and emotionally. And this article, this long piece by Natasha Perlman is a sort of interesting piece, definitely. There were definitely, for me, 2 things that came around about the discussion of this. Namely, there were comments at the bottom of the article that upset me a lot, I have to say, because as it now sometimes happens with social media, there was just a sort of long discussion, and somebody voiced the opinion there that Natasha Perlman was clearly just out there and doing some attention seeking by sort of giving people this lengthy story about her horrible birth. And to my mind, that is really absolutely not true. I don't think anybody has an interest in getting attention by way of such an intimate story. So that was very upsetting to me that people take it in that way. And it was also encouragement to think that there is something, I think, that we need to do to make it a lot more acceptable to talk about these things. And in the longer run, also to get more stories and to encourage people to tell stories in the kind of way that they are comfortable with. Because sort of phenomenologically speaking, it will be good to really see better how the experience works out. The other thing that was striking to me in the article was that there was a sort of suggestion that it is better to rely on gynecologists as in contrast to midwives. And this move that is suggested there from midwives to doctors is from the perspective of myself as somebody who has experienced the German obstetrician-centered approach, not a good suggestion. I said that it says more later, but then I thought later on is also not necessarily a good moment. Let me just also be a little bit personal and hopefully not appear too much attention seeking. The moment when that became clear to me, I have three sons by now, and when I was pregnant for the first time in 2006, I was initially here for my antenatal care, and I was quite shocked that the English midwives just only asked me how I was doing and then sent me home again. I was thinking, this is not what I'm used to. And then I moved to Berlin, where I actually gave birth to my first son, and was back in the obstetrician-centered system. And so that means a full gynecological exam for every antenatal examination. And at some moment, my gynecologist started talking about a right-wing politics book that had just appeared at the time. And he didn't know how much of a nerve that was sort of hitting in me, but I was just thinking, he should know that this is not on. There should just be some awareness that in the middle of a full gynecological exam with metals, speculum, and so on, and me being pregnant, I'm much too vulnerable to say anything about this. So I was just very much against my will going, when really I wanted to say that I completely disagree with this idea of foreigners should leave Germany and whatnot. And I also later on then started thinking, what is the purpose of a full gynecological exam when it comes to birth matters? It's really not so clear to me. So I think my module and generally my engagement with midwives has a lot to do with this approach on talk, on communication. And I think that one lesson that one can rather take out of these stories is not that we should criticize midwives for having the wrong terminology or the wrong campaign, but that really midwives matter a lot and that needs acknowledgement. And when one looks into it more closely and looks at people's stories, it seems that they make a difference not just to the experience of birth, which is very important, but even to the level of complications. Then we also take from it, of course, that words matter and that concepts matter. And that's where phenomenology comes in on the one hand. But also, when we look at this new campaign, Better Births, it would seem that in order to see how to make it better, we need to understand what is going on or what the experience actually is. And that could also be a good task for phenomenology. Now, with the normal birth terminology, it seems to me that one problem with this is that birth as an experience is already the opposite of normal. So even the most normal birth from the general medical perspective is as an experience quite abnormal and especially beforehand unimaginable and uncanny, if one wants to use this sort of Heideggerian unheimlich term, and in any case quite strange. So that was why I then ended up embarking on a book called Pregnancy, Birth, Being with Infants, Phenomenology of a Strange Experience. And again, I'm now going to just walk you through some of the bits of that, indicating especially kind of how I am trying to go about things. So these are kind of the chapters and the subsection titles, and I think the subsections indicate quite well what the chapters are about. So the introduction, not quite exactly what you would perhaps normally expect from an introduction, already goes into quite a bunch of themes. It starts with the midwives as philosophers as midwives. That is something which then very explicitly went into the Royal College of Midwives module, because the citation that Socrates uses when he explains that his work is much like that of a midwife is quite a nice one. And what I also liked in that citation is that Socrates says that he is helping like a midwife, but it's not his baby. And the fact that the birth comes about is sort of partly the work of heaven and partly his help. And that sort of made me aware that there is indeed something about the work of a midwife that is not just a lot like a philosopher, but even a bit, in a sense, like an angel, because there is indeed a sort of heavenly component, as it were, because something that seems unimaginable actually becomes a possibility. And I put that at the beginning of the module because it's sort of part of making it clear how incredibly important this profession is. Then there is stuff there about birth as paradox or paradigm. That has something to do with the way in which birth is could be said to be paradoxical, because it goes against our normal opinion, our doxa of sorts, about what it is to be a body, because in our idea of what it is to be a body, and we have heard quite a lot of interesting things about that this morning, my body is mine, and there is nobody else suddenly in my body. But if there is somebody in my body, then that makes it indeed quite unimaginable that this somebody could get out of my body in such a way that then we would have two bodies afterwards and both of them would still be all right. It goes against our experience of what a body is. So that's a bit paradoxical. And on the other hand, birth can in a sense be a paradigm in a bunch of ways. So on the one hand, in the sense that there is somebody in me, and this is something which Levinas, for example, presents as a situation in which something is literally the case that is otherwise also the case, but it's more difficult to see how this metaphorical having the other in oneself can be, but then at the same time pregnancy could help understand how that is possible, because the transitions sort of from carrying the other in oneself to then carrying the other outside oneself are somehow smoother in a sense than one would think. And it kind of makes sense that once the baby is born, they are still in a sense in me, in this Levinasian sense of very much permeating me and my experiences and my responsibility, even though they are now no longer literally in. The other way in which birth would be paradigmatic would have something to do, and this is indeed very closely linked, to the way in which life is just intrinsically very relational, and our experience depends very, very much on others and on relating to others and communicating with others. And birth is one of those experiences when we are also really relying on others, on the one hand in the shape of healthcare professionals with whom we must communicate, and they are indeed usually strangers, but also communicating to those who are very close to us, partners or husbands and whatnot. And that is also not at all easy. So there's also something sort of paradigmatic to be learned there, to try and overcome those things that prevent us from talking comfortably about our emotions or our bodily experiences, especially when they involve genitals and so on and so forth. Then there are some comments about the different dimensions of strangeness, about the unfamiliar, the uncanny, the unsayable, difficulties of expressing all of that. A little bit about phenomenology as a method, which comes then much longer. And there's a sort of phrase that carries through the book, in a sense. This is the Celan citation, "The world is gone, I must carry you," that Derrida discusses in Rams. And I find it quite a helpful sort of picture, in a sense, because on the one hand, indeed, Derrida does a lot of interesting things developing in ethics out of that. And this is odd problem in the sense that there is a carrying always already going on, so to speak. And so it's not a matter of saying how things should be, but how things already are and what responsibility emerges from that. And then carrying is also indeed something that happens a lot around pregnancy and birth and being with infants, because Derrida comments how pregnancy is a kind of carrying, but there's also a whole lot of carrying, of course, going on after the birth that also still in, I mean, it's lovely in lots of ways, but it's also at the same time the sort of thing where I would again say that Levinas is quite right to use the sort of hostage expression in regards to my relationship to the other. So there's also definitely a kind of being taken hostage. My youngest son is now 4.5 and is starting school tomorrow. And when he gets unhappy, then it's just, still just a matter of, carry me, you are too heavy. But it just seems to be a particular sort of expression of vulnerability or something sort of that perhaps goes back to some original connection, who knows. Okay, what I'm at the beginning of the book trying to do, and again, I will just really only indicate this very briefly, is to start from some main concepts that I found particularly helpful. And you don't really have philosophers' names there in these subheadings, but I think you can very easily guess them, you know. So there is the main concepts are world and body and intersubjectivity and intercorporeality. When it comes to world, there's sort of with each of these, I've been trying to do a kind of vaguely speaking dialectics, but about just sort of how the concept develops from the initial perspective, often in Husserl, to something that sort of walks us a little bit in the direction of Heidegger and Merleau-Ponty, and then more like the late phenomenologists, where indeed historical worlds become important. And for body, there is also a bit of Sartre there and a bit of Irigaray, and with the body as vulnerability and exposure, of course, Levinas again. So all those people I like to read a lot, and I was indeed very happy to find that they could help me shed some light on the experiences. On the other hand, it was sort of difficult to try and present these phenomenological main ideas on just a few pages. The intercorporeality thing, that's an expression from Merleau-Ponty about which he says extremely little. Bernhard Weidenfels then picks that up. I think when one takes this phenomenological insight seriously, that we don't really have a body, but that we are a body, then it's also worthwhile trying to see whether instead of intersubjectivity, where we still always need to ask what is the subject and what do we mean by subjectivity, whether one could not maybe indeed go with this expression intercorporeality for our relationships to one another. And then it's again also a situation where it would seem that this pregnancy birth topic seamlessly also blends into other topics that are a little bit related. So intercorporeality is, for example, also at issue when one would write about dance, as I have done at some point, or about sexual activity, as I have once tried briefly. So there are lots of interesting things that one could do with that. I start with concepts and then go to method because of the sort of impression that in phenomenology it gets a bit frustrating if one wants to discuss method in empty space, and it becomes easier if one already looks at particular phenomena and chooses the concepts accordingly. So then this chapter 2 is actually relatively brief because it allows me to rely on the on the development of the concepts that sort of naturally led on from static to genetic phenomenology. And then, yeah, there is a sort of question whether there is a third phase of phenomenology, and if so, how to call that in Husserl's scholarship. Derrida suggested that there is a distinct phase after genetic phenomenology in his introduction to Husserl's Origin of Geometry, and he suggests to call it historical phenomenology. And I have by now come to believe that he's right. For the longest time, I was reading lots of Tony Steinbock, with whom I also worked a little bit in the States, and I thought that generative phenomenology, like Steinbock calls it, would be a good term. And for my pregnancy, the birth stuff, in a sense, that would have perhaps been the more sort of the closer possibility. But I do think that history and also storytelling and so on is indeed very important. And when it comes to the German, there is Geschichte has both the story and the history thing in it. Doesn't quite work out that well in English, but I think it's still at least somewhat implied. And then there is some other stuff there that I would find too complicated to explain now, plus I'm indeed just sort of picking up little bits and pieces. This phenomenological ethnography is so something that I'm sort of trying to talk about my own experiences and other people's experiences in a sort of language that feels appropriate, and that is a bit difficult, but I'm practicing, so to speak, practicing this kind of writing. Okay, so that would have been the part one done, which has to do with concepts and methodology, and then the rest of the book is kind of structured like the title has it, pregnancy, birth, being with infants, and I have two chapters in each part. And I'm trying to, I mean, it doesn't quite fully work out, but I'm always trying to have the first chapter sort of about the emotional side and the experience itself, and the second chapter more about the relational side and how the other gets into that. So starting just with the description of pregnant embodiment and what it does to my world. And there are a number of things that sort of come out, but perhaps one of the most striking ones has to do with this world removal, that stuff that I do with Merleau-Ponty and Heidegger, and that has sort of to do with the way in which world gets removed from me as it just becomes increasingly difficult to reach stuff and to get into the different levels, sort of pick up stuff from high and pick up stuff from below. So world just in general is feels less accessible. And I mean, the sort of good thing about those kinds of discoveries is that one can then also think about birth as a way not just of regaining one's habit body eventually, but also a kind of way of regaining world as it has become sort of increasingly removed, because especially during the last weeks or days before birth, it can just feel that the world is just really too far removed and needs to come back. But there are again also some lessons then to be learned for general forms of being in the world. There's a chapter on touch, and that is one of those moments that is sort of interesting to me again, because, I mean, I've already indicated this in the beginning when I said something about the paradigm bit, namely that there is something that sort of explicitly happens during pregnancy, namely the possibility of being touched from the inside, which then also would allow to think about more generally how the other can touch me as if from within, even if it is not a touch in the literal sense. And there's some Nancy there, and some more Derrida, and also some Irigaray. Yeah, that was actually that was a funny experience. If you again allow me to be a little bit anecdotal, I had a paper on that I tried to submit. Didn't get it accepted so far. But what was interesting about that was I was coming from this Irigaray emphasis that it's quite a different thing whether you carry somebody on the outside of your body or whether you carry somebody inside your body. And she says it's also a very important difference whether you have sex outside your body or in your body. And I was just sort of quoting that, and then some reviewer wrote comments about saying, well, how about anal sex? Isn't that also a being touched from the inside when it comes to male corporeality? So I'm still thinking about that footnote about how to respond to that. But it was just, I had never read a review in which I was prompted to say a little something about anal sex. So, interesting. The kind of things that you suddenly experience for the first time when you write about an unusual topic. Part three, in a sense, is indeed sort of at the core of things and also what reflects most immediately on the midwife's module. So I think I will skip over part four almost entirely. But part three, again, is where emotions come in and where my special friend Heidegger comes in, whom I always like to bring into these kinds of considerations. And now that people seem to read him less and less, I'm more and more sort of enthusiastic about showing all the things that one can do with his philosophy. So that has the title, Who's Afraid of Birth? I don't want to be too sort of self-serving, self-promoting, but if anybody thinks, I wish she would, instead of giving us this outline, I wish she would just talk about one of the chapters in a bit of detail, then I actually did do that, and it's somewhere on YouTube if you are curious. Because there was a talk that I gave at Sussex in 2015. So that is sort of all about that. And the reason why that topic of anxiety around birth is very important to me is because it seemed to me when I was investigating it and also doing lots of interviews and so on, that that one of the reasons why we talk so little about this anxiety around birth is that we sort of think that it's braver not to talk about it. And we also kind of think that we know what the anxiety is about because we kind of presume that it's about pain. And so then in a sense, there's either nothing to talk about or what there is to talk about is very medical. But if one takes a kind of Heideggerian approach, then there is a lot more going on. The emotional landscape is a lot richer than that. And then it can be quite interesting to indeed sort of start with this Heideggerian distinction between fear and anxiety and think about how the anxiety around birth also has a lot to do with the fact that it's just really so unknown and so unimaginable and so uncanny that in a sense is much more at the core of the existential, deeper emotion that is at stake there. And I also found that the Heideggerian sort of mundane versus existential affects distinction was helpful because I think it becomes more understandable how a whole bunch of seemingly little mundane fears just sort of get a different dimension when they are permeated by this existential anxiety. So some of the ways in which one sees women reacting, for example, on this British show, One Born Every Minute, that is currently going into season 99 or so, it seems, it sort of feels a bit as if people are ridiculous, but they are a bit ridiculous for a very good reason, because it's indeed an absolutely abnormal situation. Anticipatory anxiousness was just kind of interesting because the phenomenological and the psychological research coincide, namely that anticipatory anxiousness can actually indeed be helpful to engage more with the situation beforehand and correlates with less anxiety in the situation when it arises. Wonder is just one of those moments to sort of remember again that Heidegger is not all about anxiety, but there are also other fundamental moods in him, and wonder is one of those, and wonder is definitely one that almost inevitably happens with birth, and in that sense also one that midwives in the kind of communication that they conduct can place an emphasis on, not necessarily using Heidegger's words, but still just sort of saying that now we are really getting closer to the point when this amazing thing is going to happen and you will actually see what it looks like and so on. So that's the anxiety and fear and wonder stuff. Then the sort of more relational component of that is a chapter that has to do with care during birth and how can we care for somebody who is in such a strange, abnormal situation. And even though I like the active birth movement and have also found Janet Velasquez very, very interesting in communications, I also find that the phenomenological notion of passivity is unfortunately missing from the discussion, not surprisingly, but it's also a helpful notion when, I mean, not so much with Husserl, but again with people like Levinas. So, and indeed sort of thinking about this letting be, but even just again on the much more mundane level, waiting around. Now, if you, again, in this series, One Born Every Minute, lots of bad stuff happens as people are just waiting around without having anything to do. And I mean, when I see that, I'm sometimes thinking, well, most any couple that I can think of, put them in a room for 24 hours, give them nothing to do, they are not going to get on that well. I mean, the first ever episode of One Born Every Minute has really horrendous behavior on the side of the husband, who blows up one of these gloves and starts sort of tickling the mother. How can it? But, you know, again, I also don't want to be somewhere without having anything to do and without having sort of anything prepared as to what one could do. But nowadays there are actually a bunch of things that one can take, also by way of digital media, for example. But more importantly, and this is sort of something that that I'm still also thinking about in the context of the sort of parent side of the project, there is something really important, very, very mundane, sounds like a complete triviality, namely birth massage. Yeah, you would think, of course, birth massage, clear. But the thing is that it's really not that easy to do the right kind of massage. I had an interesting conversation with the head of impact at the University of Sussex, whose wife was giving birth in Japan, and they got instructed on proper birth massage there. And he said that during the process, he massaged through the fabric of his wife's robe entirely, through the entire fabric. And that is that sounds about right to me. I mean, that's how intense a birth massage must be. And one reason why I have come to not find it so trivial is also that that midwives are not necessarily in the, I mean, I had one experience, my third birth, a home birth, where the British home birth guidelines say that you have to provide the midwives with some food, and a snack might not necessarily be sufficient. So my partner was in the kitchen, and I asked whether the midwives could maybe continue the massage, and that was no good. So it's not that trivial. It's also not that trivial to talk about it, which is, again, where sort of phenomenology and discourse and so on comes into the picture. Okay, I'm now basically going to not tell you about this, maybe just a teensy bit about chapter 7, and then I'm going to jump. Because, again, I want to get to this practice bit and the online module. I changed this somewhere. See, this is always the problem when you have a PowerPoint presentation and you also have a Word document. And I had been told before that this term liquidity, that I should just stop using it. So on the handout, it says fluidity. But what this basically is an attempt to think about the elements and in a sense, even also a little bit the pre-Socratics and Nietzsche and that kind of stuff and water and so on, and thinking about how being with a newly born requires us to establish very elemental kinds of relationships with somebody else that we are not used to anymore in our normal life. And then there is also some stuff about how we could even consider things like rhythm a kind of elemental relation. But again, that takes a bit of unpacking. And this kind of stuff takes even more unpacking. This is sort of about intercorporeality. And there's also a discussion with the psychological literature a little bit, and then what phenomenology could offer. And then there is also an attempt to write a conclusion that looks still pretty mixed and so on. And there was an appendix. Oh, yeah, that's right. I just only mentioned that briefly down there. This is sort of also where the ethnographies end up. So, moving on from the sort of theory bit to the practice bit is this, basically. So this is a screenshot of the actual module, which is only accessible to members of the Royal College of Midwives. So this was a screenshot that I took long time ago when I still had access as test midwife, and now I can't get access anymore, I found last night. I think maybe only one or so person in this room might recognize who this is on the picture. So it happens to be a PhD student from Sussex, Arthur. So this was one of the interviews that I did. And the reason why I took a little clip from the interview with Arthur and used it for the module is that he was describing very nicely how the birth massage was giving him the sense to be really part of the situation. And he was using the image of a ship. He said it was like, it felt like being on a ship and kind of bracing the waves together. I just kind of liked that as an image for intercorporeality. There's stories were overall quite interesting because it was also a story where the communication with the midwives was really crucial, and that the communication didn't go so well during the first birth and was then going really quite well for the second birth. And even though many of the processes were the same, it just made a big difference to talk about it differently with the midwives and have a sort of midwife that was more willing to talk things through in detail. So this is just, again, basically the table of contents of the module. And I'm just putting this here to allow you to see how there are these connections. So Socrates as a midwife, then I'm trying to explain a little bit why philosophers are so obsessed with concepts and also why I'm using so many examples and what I'm trying to draw from those, why emotions are even important. Then comes a 3-minute version of the anxiety stuff, so explaining Heidegger to midwives and also using the name Heidegger. Then a wondrous experience, sort of the thing to look forward to, that comes at the end of it. Being a body between subject and object, and the sort of the pregnant body feeling like a whale. And then there's a voluntary chapter, Sartre and de Beauvoir, on subject and object, where I get a bit more technical, so to speak. That is just a kind of philosophical perspective that I try to bring in there to kind of explain, on the one hand, how in general we have a problem in healthcare situations if we feel that we are treated like just a physical body, like just an object, and not really being taken seriously enough as a subject that also has an opinion and preferences and a history with regard to all of these things. But I also had in my first birth, I had quite an interesting sort of Sartrean moment. At least that's what it felt like to me, a sort of moment of the look. Because there was a situation, and this was again one of those moments from which I later on sort of drew the conclusion that midwives are extremely important, and also the communication with them. There was a moment when the obstetrician said to me, well, you know, you can of course also have an epidural if you feel that you need one. And this is sort of perhaps interesting. I mean, I'm sure we are probably going to talk about that in the discussion anyway, this sort of stuff about natural birth and the discussion as it has happened in the media. I don't want to say that somehow there should be that natural birth or normal birth should be a paradigm. Rather, what I'm trying to say is just that it's something quite difficult to hold on to anyway in the situation as a kind of ideal or hypothesis. And so in that sense, it can be helpful to at least initially sort of set it up as something that is worth striving for. Because what happened to me in that situation when the obstetrician said, well, or you can have an epidural if you think that you need one, was that I started thinking, and I even remember arguing with him along those lines. I mean, so what I felt like was like, he thinks that I'm somebody who will need an epidural anyway. He looks at me as the kind of person who will need one. So I will probably need one. So I became this person that I felt he saw me as, you know. And so then I started saying, well, if you think I need one anyway, then I would probably better have one now so that I have more benefit. At which point, I presume, I don't know, the midwife thought, well, if she is still arguing like that, then she's not anywhere close to despair. And she just said, or maybe you won't need one. So let's first try a bit more. Oh, yeah, that's right. Maybe I won't need one. And that was sort of enough to remind me that I had gone into the situation thinking, well, let's try without. It's there's no such thing as a right solution, but it's just a very abnormal situation. And so what people say can be extra important. And so to be also extra encouraging about somebody's capacities and the need to wait a bit and so on is not the same as saying, look, you're a failure if you don't go through with this to the end. But on the other hand, the fact that this midwife was there and was encouraging me was the kind of thing that then also made me think, well, this is interesting because lots of different births also give different kinds of stories, and then one can see later on as to sort of how it feels and what the advantages and disadvantages, so to speak, are. The module then continues with a kind of reflection exercise for midwives, just also learning to reflect on the other person's perspective. Of course, when I presented my module to the Royal College, that was the kind of thing that they, I think, took most issue with, because they were saying, well, midwives do that anyway. Yeah, but, you know, it's one of those things that we really need to remind ourselves of, and that is not as simple as just the expression reflection would indicate, namely really taking the perspective of the mother for whom this is a really, really abnormal and unimaginable and uncanny kind of thing, whereas for the midwife, it's an everyday kind of thing, and this kind of clash is something that seems worth reflecting on, but also language and what have I said and what did the other person look like after I said that, and did I maybe sometimes say something that I could phrase differently or better. Then there's also something, this is kind of trying to spell out the Weidenfeld's notion of responsivity that he took from Merleau-Ponty and Levinas and so on, by kind of encouraging, I mean, responsivity in the phenomenological sense is basically kind of responsivity to the situation and to the person. And in order to do that in birth, it seemed not a bad idea to place an emphasis on asking and observing. Yes, I will say a little bit more about, or let me just for a moment jump to 14, silence, please, because I felt that after I had put this bit in about asking and observing, I again remembered one of my experiences during birth, when there was a midwife who was asking me every few minutes, how are you doing? And initially I was quite okay with that, and I also kept on thinking, yeah, this is what I thought is good, right? Talking, communication with midwives talking. And then I realized, no, this is not really the situation for much talking, because initially I just said, okay, I think I'm okay given the circumstances. And then I just didn't want to respond anymore, because there's also a sense in which in the situation itself, words are not really that helpful, and needing to find words over and over again wasn't that helpful. And also getting the same question over and over again wasn't that great, because I was still thinking, well, I cannot give the same answer each time, so I have to vary my answer. And then at the end, I just kind of thought it. Just thought, uh-huh, and that's sort of enough. So, but what I meant by asking and observing was also kind of asking whether the person wants to talk, asking whether the person wants explanations, because a lot of times people don't really get all the information they need, but sometimes they have all the information and don't really want to talk, and then it would also be good to be responsive to that. Then this 11, 12, 13 comes out of it being a kind of communication module, and I also had a communication scholar who helped me with that. But one of the reasons why there is something like persuasive communication was because, I wanted to explain, and this already in a sense comes out of the feeling like a whale bit of things, that the pregnant body, especially at that final stage, just feels so abnormal that certain basic things that we know are no longer so clear at all, and that therefore we also sometimes need midwives to remind us and also sometimes to persuade us to do certain things. Because, you know, when we talk about it here, then probably everybody in this room who has ever sort of been present at a birth or heard anything about birth would have already heard at some point that it's not a good idea to be on one's back when giving birth. But in the situation itself, that's not at all so clear, because maneuvering this body that feels really unreal and abnormal and whale-like makes it difficult to keep all those things at the forefront of one's consciousness, so to speak. Me last time being anecdotal. My second birth was a water birth, because I thought, okay, I didn't think let's try different things, but I had meant to have a water birth on the first one, and it didn't quite work out that way. But in the water situation, I went into the bathtub like one normally does, and so I was on my back, and that ruined the whole thing. As far as the experience goes, it was ultimately less preferable than the non-water births. So I would have needed the midwives to remind me that despite the fact that I'm now thinking I'm in a bathtub and I'm in my sort of normal bathtub position, it's better for birth to be in a different position. But since nobody prompted me and it just sort of fell out of my head that I basically know this, it didn't come to me, so I would have needed that, and I would have also, I think, needed somebody to sort of to speak to me on the level of body language and just help me around, so to speak. Yeah. So. Will be less. those are basically the sort of reminders at the end. Then there are also some reading recommendations, and the Royal College in the end recommended that midwives do an e-diary for reflections in order to get a kind of credit for this module. So initially we had a quiz, and I devised horrible quiz questions that I just really felt very yucky about, but I hate multiple choice in university contexts too, and in that context it was somehow particularly ridiculous. But then luckily the educational advisor from the Royal College also got back and said, well, look, why wouldn't we not do a quiz here, but rather encourage midwives to use an e-diary for reflections. And I was also then able to look at some of the entries, and that was certainly very interesting. And now I'm basically almost finished. So when I say that I am now hoping to address parents, then I'm also sort of trying to figure out how to best address parents. And I've had conversations about that with people at my university, because my naive idea, me not really being an internet specialist by any means, was that a website would be good where certain resources could be collected and presented. And people at my university who seem to know more about this keep on saying, well, you can only do that if you interlink this web page really well, or if you sort of find a way to really set this web page up in such a way that it really works. So if you know anything about that, let me know, because I'm certainly still determined, but I have also been told that I shouldn't just simply put a web page there and hope that somehow people will find it and that it will do some good. But basically, the idea of it is to sort of, in line with what Keith said at the beginning about also mediating between midwives and parents and so on, to try and present the parent side of things in this kind of project, and talk about how important communication is, talk about how important it is to prepare for birth together, waiting, massage, all those kinds of things that I have already mentioned. And I don't yet quite know how. I have also sort of started writing a different kind of book in German. So this is the book that is still by and large an academic book, because there is, as you could tell, Heidegger and Levinas and Derrida and Nancy and Irigaray and so on all over it. But I'm also trying to now write something that doesn't have any of that and would be a general audience kind of book. And those kinds of things exist in German. There's, for example, a philosophical travel guidebook that my doctoral supervisor wrote at some point, Treffpunkt Platon. And so, I'm experimenting with the idea of that. But again, I'm also still very much open for suggestions and general opinions and feedback. So thank you very much for listening.